Hi, you're listening to Hear This Idea. In this episode, we speak to Rory Stewart, who is currently the president of GiveDirectly and a visiting fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. Of all our guests, I think that it's going to be hard to find someone with such a varied CV as Rory. Most recently, Rory was a British politician, having been a member of parliament for almost a decade, and during that time holding several cabinet positions, including briefly acting as Secretary of State for International Development. Before that, Rory was a soldier, a diplomat, a coalition deputy governor in Iraq, ran his own NGO, a professor of human rights, the author of several books, and a podcast host himself. All of that is to say that I think we could have easily asked an audiobook's worth of questions here. But in this interview, we wanted to specifically focus on GiveDirectly. To give some context, there have been many randomized controlled trials and independent reviews which find that just giving money to the extreme poor is actually very cost-effective. And there are also hopes that this could be repeatable and scalable in a way that nothing else in development economics seems to be. As with everything, this is actually a pretty wonky literature. For example, the independent charity evaluator GiveWell thinks that whilst GiveDirectly is, quote, one of the strongest programs it's found, that there continue to be other opportunities, many of them focused on health, that can be up to 10 times more cost-effective on current margins, but which still go unfunded. And there's of course also a range of ethical questions that go into any such cost-effective calculations. If you're interested in that literature, then we've added a list of readings on our website, including a podcast interview with GiveDirectly's founders, Michael Fay and Paul Neilhaus, as well as GiveWell's write-up on GiveDirectly. But putting econometrics aside, in this interview, we wanted to specifically ask Rory about his ambitious vision for GiveDirectly. Rory argues that we shouldn't just look on the current margin for how to do the most good, which for context, for GiveWell is on the order of $500 million a year. But instead, try to think seriously about creating a world where we get hundreds of billions of dollars used to end extreme poverty. And on that scale, Rory says that nothing looks as convincing as cash. Rory thinks that this plan really is feasible, that we can raise and redirect very large amounts of money by changing the minds of people working on large government budgets or at international financial institutions. And Rory also very much used to work at these exact kinds of institutions he is now hoping to convince, and also on the exact kinds of projects that he is now advocating that we should replace with the much more straightforward approach of direct cash transfers. Since he's therefore radically changed his own mind on this topic, Finn and I were really curious to hear more about what he has to say. So without further ado, here's the episode.
Okay, Rory Stewart, thanks for joining us.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Well, I understand you're calling from Amman in Jordan, and I'm curious what first brought you to Jordan.
So I first came here because I was working along with my wife with Syrian refugees in Jordan, particularly supporting Syrian refugee craftspeople and helping them set up their businesses and training again. In fact, you can probably hear the call to prayer in the background coming through the microphone at the moment as we're speaking. And then while I was here, I was approached by GiveDirectly. I went to visit Rwanda with Michael Fay, who's the founder of GiveDirectly, and became really entranced by the model of what they were doing, very excited by what they were doing. And then since then, I've been working for GiveDirectly.
Fantastic. And when was this, when you first moved to Jordan and visited Rwanda as well?
So I moved to Jordan December 2 years ago, and I went to Rwanda in April of last year.
Awesome. And before you moved to Jordan and are now GiveDirectly, you had a really long political career, and in particular, you were Secretary of State for International Development. And I'm curious what kind of lessons you learned in that role. And maybe in particular, I want to ask how much of, you know, the UK's overseas development assistance budget you would now allocate to unconditional cash transfers, given what you know now.
I would allocate the vast majority now of our overseas development assistance to unconditional cash. But at the time, I was very resistant. And in fact, I think it's something I've had to reflect on a lot, why as Secretary of State and as a minister before that, I resisted unconditional cash transfers and am now a total convert. And of course, part of the answer to that is that it was really for me only being on the ground in Rwanda and seeing the impact of the money firsthand that I really began to understand how revolutionary it was, how miraculous it was. Within a bureaucracy like DFID in those days, now FCDO, there are any number of reasons psychological, self-interested, why people don't like direct cash transfer. And one of the biggest reasons, of course, is, and it was something very aware of, is that it raises the question, what are we all doing? I had many thousands of civil servants in DFID. They were health specialists, nutrition specialists, education specialists who are putting all this energy into designing these very complicated programs. A single business case would take over a year to design. And if the truth was that we were better simply giving unconditional cash, it was slightly doubtful whether any of us were required at all.
Another question we were wondering about is, if you're trying to figure out where to spend overseas development assistance, then there are charity evaluators. GiveWell comes to mind as maybe the top one that spends, you know, thousands of person hours trying to find some of the most promising opportunities just to spend money on alleviating poverty. Even short of just giving money to unconditional cash transfers, why not just top up all of these recommended charities until they no longer have these big funding gaps, which they still have?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think GiveWell is a very interesting example, and I have huge admiration for them. But if you look at their recommended charities at the moment, the truth is they would not be able to absorb the kind of cash that I had. I had a budget of $20 billion a year to give away per year, right? And therefore, one of the challenges, in fact, with the GiveWell model is what do you do with the $170 billion a year of international development assistance? How should that be spent? It's all very well finding some very high return investments, specifically in malaria and so-and-so, which can absorb $200 or $300 million.
If, you know, the room for more funding is, you know, only limited in some sense of maybe $500 million or $1 billion a year, then I think in some ways that seems even more striking that governments aren't able to just like fill that up to its entirety. Or like, why does that room for more funding like still exist? Is it just because if something is below a billion, then it's like not worth even like looking at for government?
Governments will very comfortably make grants. I mean, bureaucracies that are dealing with 20 billion prefer to make larger grants because the admin costs are lower. So they prefer to make grants of 10, 20, 30 million if they can. A dream to make a $100 million grant. But no, they certainly could. I think it's partly about values and what people's priorities are. So in the case of DFID, the central priority was extreme poverty. It wasn't life expectancy, infant mortality. And that is important. Some money went into that. And in fact, you know, DFID was a big supporter of Gavi and the Vaccine Alliance. But primarily, the question that it would have been asking when it was shown a project is, what is the contribution of this to lifting the extreme poor out of poverty? Not what is the contribution of this to ensuring that fewer children die? And that's one of the one of the questions around a number of these evaluators, which are putting a very, very strong weight on life and perhaps less of a weight on improving people's material conditions.
It occurs to me that there is a question about which areas you might prioritize within overseas development. But there's another question about just how high you aim, and in particular, just how large your budget is, how much of your overall spending you're giving to aid. And I want to ask, how can we get to a world where the UK and other rich countries just have higher ambitions around development? So maybe up to single digit percentages of GDP rather than, you know, much less than the 0.7 target we have now.
I think that the key to this is hope. The key to this is people believing that there are valuable projects, because these development budgets are very dependent on voters. And the reality is that there is despair amongst most of the public. The perception is that trillions of dollars has been spent on international development since the Second World War. And particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, it's often difficult to feel the impact. I mean, bluntly, there were 170 million people living in extreme poverty in sub-Saharan Africa in 1980. There are 470 million living in extreme poverty in sub-Saharan Africa today. And That is notwithstanding the colossal sums of money that are spent. Added to which, the people like GiveWell are effectively implying at the moment that there's only a few hundred million dollars worth of worthwhile projects, at the same time as you're trying to suggest that the world increases expenditure to 1 or 2% of global GDP, which would take you up into the hundreds of billions. So I think there is a paradox here.
And in what ways do you think that an NGO like GiveDirectly can, you know, have an effect here, either in changing voter perceptions or in changing government agendas? Like, what's the kind of like limit for what you think is realistic?
I don't think there's any limit in the end. I think in the end, the logic of cash is overwhelming. There are many other good projects that you can do. Some projects, indeed, which at a small scale have a better return on investment, but there is nothing which is as replicable or scalable as cash. There's nothing which can reliably absorb hundreds of billions of dollars in the way that cash can. And therefore, I think the end of this story has to be the international development community putting the majority of its money into cash. The question is, when will it get there? We've had more than 300 academic studies on cash. We have extraordinary numbers of randomized control tests that we can share. We have benchmarking studies. If you're looking for something that can absorb, well, I think two things. Firstly, that can absorb very large sums of money, regardless of context, absorb hundreds of billions of dollars, and can be done in Liberia as much as in Kenya. They don't require a strong, specific route. And secondly, if your primary concern is not niche questions such as health, but poverty in general, in other words, if you're actually genuinely committed to SDG 1, I think the logic drives you in the direction of cash. The problem is the incredible psychological barriers that exist preventing people giving cash. And these psychological barriers are not overcome for most people simply by sharing the results of randomized control tests. It's too easy for people to say, well, you've been successful. Yes, we can see you've been successful at a village level and a district level, but we don't know what's going to happen at a national level. And of course, by the time you get onto a national level, it's very, very difficult doing an RCT because you've got to a scale where the control group becomes almost impossible.
I was actually meaning to ask about almost that exact question. So even if we could persuade people with the very clear results you mentioned at the smaller scale, at the village level, if we're thinking about scaling cash transfers in a big way, then we should be interested in whether they could eventually lift entire countries out of poverty. And we should be interested in whether that effect lasts. You know, it's not what you might call a band-aid. And we don't have direct evidence of this happening because we haven't tried it yet. I'm curious what you could say to that question. You know, why expect this to work?
I mean, what comes to? I mean, I think the first thing is that there are two main things that trouble people about the question of these national programs. One is, as you say, is the question of the sustainability of it. And there, Chris Blackman's work in Uganda, which traces the impact over not just 9 years now, but 12 years, is interesting because it seems that a single transfer of a few hundred dollars 12 years ago, its impact compared to the control group was beginning to drop off after 9 years, and then it diverged again towards the 12-year level, which is very interesting, and that's partly because of COVID. And what appears to have happened is that the people put sufficient amount of that money into assets that it gave them resilience through COVID, allowing them to diverge from the control group. So that's exciting because it's suggesting that that sum of money, which I think in real terms about $350 12 years ago, is something that you can still see a measurable impact compared to the control group 12 years later. So that, I think that is helpful. But of course, as you say, this is happening at a smaller scale, and that was a semi-conditional transfer directed towards young people working in business. So it doesn't tell you everything about what would happen with a similar single cash transfer over 12 years. And actually, one of the problems is that running a 12-year randomized control trial is unbelievably expensive, and there are very few of them in the world. Second thing I think is the question of macroeconomic impacts, particularly inflation. And there we've done a study in Kenya in which it appears at the moment that there is, for every dollar that goes in, there's $2.50 of economic impact across the surrounding area with minimal impact on inflation. But again, it's difficult to know whether the lack of an inflation impact at a scale of 100,000 would be true at a scale of 10 million people. Here, I think you have to have some courage, and you have to say that so much money, I mean, has been spent with so little impact over the last 70 years that spending $2 or $3 billion in a single country on delivering a single transfer to everybody in extreme poverty in that country is worth trying. In the very worst case scenario, it's likely to leave millions of people better off than they were. And in the best case scenario, it may well have a transformatory impact on the economy of that country and then provide a model which can then be followed elsewhere. And this is another thing that when people talk about return on investment, they tend to be thinking about the immediate impacts in that particular area. But here is the potential return on investment where spending $3 billion could actually affect the expenditure of the $170 billion a year of international development spend going forward. So could have a much, much bigger ROI. Again, calculating this is difficult. And, you know, I was talking to a very, very distinguished economist 10 days ago who's a huge fan of RCTs and of GiveDirectly's programs. And her response was, I think this is a very good thing to try. We don't know exactly whether it's going to work, but why not? Why not give it a go? But I think this question of why not is important, but it's also important if we're to do it to persuade somebody to give us $2 or $3 billion to do it, and that requires trying to persuade major philanthropists to be interested in doing this kind of thing. Because my instinct is it probably would need to be done by philanthropists first, and then later by governments.
Briefly returning to the kind of question of governments. You mentioned before that civil servants and ministers are acting under all kinds of constraints. And some of those constraints might be put into the category of, not being able to have the full information available, or like having some types of biases that even if they want to prioritize poverty alleviation, they might not be able to do so fully. But then there might also be a second kind of cluster of reasons that prioritizing poverty alleviation isn't the only incentive or something that they're like maximizing for. I like often hear that, I think, like in discourse, the overseas development aid also has all other types of like priorities, like from governments and stuff. And I'm just curious from your own experience within government, like how true you feel that is, or how able you think an organization like DFID.
Yeah. So look at the DFID, of course, under its International Development Act, in its original form when I ran it, had been very carefully protected from the temptations that other development agencies face. It wasn't allowed to give tide aid, wasn't allowed to, build dams with British engineers. And the Development Act focused it on the question of poverty alleviation. And the culture within that department was pretty allergic to the idea of thinking about the UK national interest or trading benefits or any of these other things. In fact, Andrew Mitchell, who was my predecessor, said that he sometimes felt that it was a sort of grand NGO, behaved almost like an NGO. That's, of course, changed a bit. And DFID has become more similar, I think, to other international development agencies in beginning to wonder whether it can leverage soft power or influence through its money. Even in its purer, earlier form, there were still many, many problems. And those problems weren't really about trying to use the money to derive UK national interest benefit. It was much more about the juddering fashions and intuitions of civil servants, politicians, and donors. And I think one of the fundamental problems in international development is a problem of vanity, which is to say, people like to believe that somebody, generally in the global north, knows something that somebody in the global south doesn't, and that what they have to do is come up with some cunning idea or some cunning scheme that somebody on the ground has never thought about. And the vanity is about thinking that what I'm contributing is not just my money, it's my brilliant brain, it's my brilliant insight. And that's one of the things that makes people allergic to cash. Because if you imagine you were a wealthy person and somebody, and you said, I'm helping poverty in Africa, and somebody said to you, oh, how interesting, what are you doing? You might be embarrassed to say, well, I'm just giving them cash. You'd prefer to say, oh no, you know, I've invented an amazing new seesaw, which is also a water pump, or I'm giving people chickens because they have eggs, or I've realized that the one thing that really matters is health, or the one thing that matters is education, or the one thing that matters is women, or the one thing that matters is climate. That the humility required to actually say, the most respectful, efficient solution is to just get out of the way and let the people who actually live in that community determine what their needs and priorities are, is very, very difficult.
Okay, I have a kind of impossibly big question. And it follows from the way we were comparing direct cash transfers to, let's say, more structural, more institution-focused, more technical kinds of assistance that you might think of when you're thinking about development. And I was interested to know what lessons you learned from the time you spent in Iraq governing provinces. So take our lessons there. This is maybe not a 2-minute answer, but I'm still curious.
Well, I've been working in and around international development in different ways for almost 30 years now. And I'm afraid my fundamental lesson is that the more time I spend in the field, and I've been to, I don't know, over 100 countries, the more disgraceful I find most international development programs to be. I mean, it's terrifying how bad things are. That was true in Iraq, where we spent, famously, the US government spent over $3 trillion and have left the country effectively no better off. I mean, it remains incredibly fragile and incredibly corrupt. Its economy has barely developed. It's true in Afghanistan. But it's true just at a much more basic level in a lot of programs that I saw in DFID, which have been funded by DFID, WASH programs in Zambia, health programs in Nigeria, education programs in Malawi, just very, very, very bad programs, and fundamentally wasteful. Often, you know, we were spending through very reputable UN agencies and NGOs, at times, I reckoned something like 90% of the money I felt was being wasted.
Was this wasted because they were good ideas, but at the level of implementation, things went wrong? Or were they just bad ideas? Or what was the failure?
So let me give you an example of a program in a particular country. We funded a WASH program with a UN agency. And the theory behind it was very appealing. The theory was that one of the reasons why adolescent girls didn't remain in school is because when they had periods, it was very difficult for them to access water and sanitation facilities. So creating water and sanitation facilities within the schools would allow girls to stay longer in school, and those extra years in school would have extraordinary benefits. At that level, it's very difficult to disagree with. And many, many DFID programs, many USAID programs operate at that kind of level, at the level of 2 or 3 sentences, which when shared on a podcast sound very plausible. In practice on the ground, what I discovered is that the budget was over $40,000 per school. And what was being done with that money was to employ very expensive engineers to conduct needs assessments, surveys, and studies, at the end of which two dry latrines, so small brick buildings with a hole in the ground, were constructed at a cost of about $1,000 each. And 5 red plastic buckets were hung on a wall allowing the girls to take the red plastic buckets to a well a few hundred meters away and come back and wash with it. Cost of red plastic buckets, $3. Cost of latrines, maybe $2,000. Cost of project, $40,000. Now, nobody was stealing money, or at least in the way in which we normally think about stealing money. But it's exactly what would happen if, instead of giving cash to a village, you tried to achieve the objectives that the village achieves with cash by sending in a UN agency or an NGO to try to deliver those things on behalf of the village. So for, let us say, $100,000 for a typical village in Rwanda, you can find within about 3 months, the village goes from 40% electrification to 80% electrification, that livestock ownership goes up to 70%, that everybody ends up with a latrine, everybody ends up with government health insurance, education enrollment goes up, nutrition goes up, small businesses are created. If you were to task a UN agency or an NGO to achieve those objectives, you would probably have to pay them $1 million at least. And it would take a very, very long time. They would survey every house. They would survey everybody about their educational needs. They would conduct nutrition programs, et cetera, et cetera. And their achievements would cost, the same outcomes would cost you 10 or 20 times as much.
That's really interesting. I think I often hear two like somewhat distinct arguments for cash transfers. One is that by any metric, they're just very cost effective. That if you look at the wealth of literature of like RCTs, at least like on the small scale, there's like a lot of evidence for them, whilst a lot of other interventions, as you said, there, you know, have these issues of vanity or biases or just like being very ineffective. But then I often also hear a more fundamental argument that it is just in principle important to give beneficiaries the agency and autonomy to decide for themselves. And what I'm kind of hearing from you is that these two arguments are actually somewhat linked, that it is that like agency and autonomy that makes things effective.
Absolutely, because I think that it's important to understand that generally local communities know more, care more, and can do more than a distant donor. So you're not simply recognizing their autonomy and dignity. You're recognizing that they actually have epistemological advantages, emotional advantages, practical advantages. And one of the biggest advantages that is unlocked by cash is the advantage of being able to do individual programs at the most micro scale. In effect, a cash program will allow each individual to come up with a quite different solution to their programs to their neighbor, to their problems to their neighbor. A blanket program might imagine that within a community, the problem for everybody is education enrollment, or the problem for everybody is nutrition because it's a nutrition program, or the problem for everybody is vaccinations, a vaccination program. But in truth, what you find in extreme poverty is that each house has a slightly different relationship to those problems. I may, through luck, have an aunt who's paying for my kids to go to school. My neighbor may have actually inherited a small plot of land, so in fact, they may be getting a little bit more nutritional input. My other neighbor may have a sick relative who requires more money for health, but the cash allows them to adjust, and it also allows the village to learn in a way that isn't possible with other programs, because if you all buy cows, I can then set up a shop selling veterinary medicine. Or if you've all been issued with mobile phones to receive your money, I can buy solar panels in order to charge those phones. But it's not necessary for somebody to very, very inefficiently attempt to do a needs assessment in that community. You would never be able to do a needs assessment rich enough to gather that form of information. Instead of which, those preferences and those needs are directly expressed through the expenditure of the cash.
I guess I'm still interested in what the role of like evidence and impact evaluation is, like even within this like cash transfer framing. And you know, feel free to kind of like reject the premise, but if we were to imagine that we were to do a really large scale cash transfer RCT, and then the evidence just happens to say, no, like inflation actually really is a problem, and this takes a large haircut on how cost effective these programs are, would you still be in a position where you would like argue for cash transfers, you know, out of these like more fundamental principle and autonomy reasons?
I'd be deeply depressed, Luca. Yeah. if I managed to raise $2 or $3 billion from you, did a big national program in a country with, let's say, 3 or 7 million people living in extreme poverty, I would be doing it on the hope that there would be a significant impact on the number of people living in extreme poverty, percentage of people living in extreme poverty in that country, and a significant sustainable impact. In other words, that some of these people would graduate, their lives would be transformed. If that turned out not to be the case, that would be a big problem for me, and I would be much less excited by cash. My excitement in cash, yes, has the moral dignity argument, but it's also extremely important to me that I think it is the most efficient, rapid way of transforming people's lives. And if I discovered that it wasn't a good way of transforming people's lives, I would lose my enthusiasm for cash quite rapidly.
So my understanding is that concretely, most cash transfers go through mobile banking. This is how the recipient actually gets hold of the money. I'm curious just how important mobile banking was to enable all of this to happen. And then as a follow-up, I'm interested whether there are other technologies that seem useful for reaching the kind of scale and ambition that you'd like to see in the world.
Firstly, you're absolutely right. Mobile technology was totally vital. The development of M-Pesa in Kenya and the rollout of mobile money in Africa allows people to give directly. It allows us to send money directly to someone's phone. And that cuts out problems of government corruption, that cuts out problems of moving cash in trucks, it cuts out the problem of the headman. It's revolutionary. But technology actually has other benefits too. So one of the things that we've been doing in urban areas where the urban poor own phones is use artificial intelligence for targeting. And we do it by analyzing how individuals use their phones, who they call, who the people that they call, where those phones are located, how much is spent on those phones. And in an article in Nature a year ago, we argued very strongly on the basis of a collaboration, the University of California and the government of Togo, that the results suggest that you can get information comparable to a 60-minute household survey from the use of this algorithm. But a 60-minute household survey can take up to a year to survey a group in a country. This allows us to gather the information in a matter of hours, and during COVID, to pay over 100,000 people in urban areas almost immediately. So technology can make a huge difference. And there are many other things that we think technology could be used for, including fraud detection, which it hasn't begun to be used for.
You mentioned M-Pesa in Kenya. Don't know if you want to say a bit about what that was and how that in particular was useful.
Well, M-Pesa essentially is a system not just for transferring money to your phone, but using your phone as a bank account and as a debit card. So you can buy biscuits by sending a text message. You can withdraw cash by sending a text message. And of course, that gives, essentially, it banks people as well as for us, giving us a very, very rich data set on people's expenditure.
Looking at some of the like new programs that GiveDirectly is doing, I saw that there are programs such as emergency relief, I believe the earthquake in Turkey, also COVID and Yemen and other types of disaster response. And I'm curious from like a technical angle, what some of the like challenges are in intervening in these crises. It feels like a very different model in some senses to what I like normally think of as GiveDirectly, which is going into rural villages and surveying people. This seems to be like much shorter timelines, and I'm curious what the like challenges are from doing that.
Responding in a conflict zone or a humanitarian context, the first challenge is security. security for our staff, security for our beneficiaries. The second challenge related to that, of course, is access and identification. And the fourth challenge, is the question of the technology that's available. Because in some of these contexts, there isn't a well-developed mobile money network. So if you're operating in Syria, we will be transferring, with Syrian refugees in southern Turkey, we will be transferring money directly to people's bank accounts rather than transferring their phones. And we usually have to work with a partner to identify who is most vulnerable in that earthquake zone. We've, in that case, focusing on Syrian refugees with small businesses, and that's something we coordinate quite closely with UN agencies and others to find that that's a neglected group that we think makes a real difference, and we have a good theory of change on why targeting that group helps. But it is the case, I'm afraid, that because of conflict, because of natural disasters, but above all, increasingly because of climate, many of the extreme poor of the world are now located in areas which are either conflict affected or extreme risk from climate. And given that our mandate is to support the extreme poor, we cannot neglect operating in these environments, even though we're having to learn all the time about how to change our techniques to work in them more effectively.
Mm. There does feel like a very concrete, real trade-off, though, between engaging in some of these spaces, which just appear so much more difficult, rather than expanding GiveDirectly's ongoing work in Kenya, for example, or other countries. What then is the reason? Is it just, as you said, that there's a lot more just like need there and kind of a moral imperative to like act in these spaces? Or is it that there's also a lot more attention from like the world more globally that you're like hoping to affect them?
Yeah. So I think the model that we're pursuing is to balance the two. And the majority of our work will continue to be, at the moment, delivering larger transfers to the extreme poor and more stable areas. So you can expect us to do very large programs in places like Rwanda, Malawi, Liberia. But we will also be doing humanitarian, climate-related programs. And that's for two reasons. Both because of the extreme need in those places, and a projection that over the next 20 to 30 years, the majority of the extreme poor in the world will live in those places, but also because there's much more funding for those areas. And we are increasingly approached by philanthropists, governments, and others who want to operate in those areas and are looking for somebody to deliver cash there.
Yeah, I think you've touched on this more than once, but just let's say in the next year, what are you planning to work on with GiveDirectly? What's the plan?
We need to do two things. We need to continue making the case for cash. And that's making the case for cash with two quite different audiences. We need to make the case for cash with traditional philanthropic donors who may be more interested in building schools or digging water wells or supporting nutrition programs. And for them, we have to explain that benchmark studies suggest that cash may be more effective than a nutrition program on nutrition, that it may be more effective than a business program on business development. And that's a tough thing to explain, but that nevertheless, that's what benchmark studies suggest. And then we have to fight a different argument with the effective altruist community. And with the effective altruist community, we need to say, it is true that you may find a few programs worth a few $100 million, which bring a good return on investment. But I believe there is nothing comparable to cash if you're interested in addressing global poverty. If you're looking for something that is focused on poverty and has a global application and can actually change the way in which the entire international development system works, I need to get the EA community much, much more interested in cash and poverty.
I guess both of us come from some kind of, you know, effective altruist perspective. And, you know, I see some tension from my own view of EA. So on one hand, you know, effective altruists really love to find the very best marginal opportunities, you know, where the next $1 million can have the most impact. And that's what GiveWell does very well, and other evaluators. But there's also at least talk about finding, about being scope sensitive, right? Really looking ahead to how do we just make the biggest difference at scale, at maybe the biggest feasible scale. And it seems like cash transfers, GiveDirectly, speak to that question, where the kind of what's marginally best answers don't really get you there.
I'm very glad to hear you say that. And I think there are two things. I think one is that one of the advantages of cash is that there is nothing which is as replicable or as scalable. And one of the struggles I had working in international development, I set up an NGO in the in Afghanistan in the mid 2005. And that was very, very effective in a very, very specific context. We worked within two city blocks, the old city of Kabul. We spent an enormous amount of money and we made a lot of difference to a few hundred lives. But if the World Bank said to me, as indeed they did, could you replicate this in 300 cities across Afghanistan, towns and cities, I couldn't do it because it was so dependent on those particular relationships. The same is true. You will find any number of really good schools or clinics run by exceptional individuals. But if you say to them, can you replicate your school 3,000 times? Of course, they can't, right? The genius of that head teacher is local. Cash is scalable and replicable in a way that nothing else is. It's much more indifferent to context. It's much more indifferent to politics. It's much more indifferent to language. It's much more indifferent to culture. And it, there is almost no limit to how much we can give in cash, which is the second major point. There are all these philanthropists out there who have literally made, some of them, you know, tens of billions of dollars, and who are saying to me that they cannot find projects to spend their money on, that there aren't projects which can absorb the amount of money they have to give. Cash can absorb that money. I can solve that problem for them. This theoretical hundreds of billions that's sitting around at the moment in people who've made giving pledges, if I could even have access to the interest of that money, we could be transforming the lives of tens of millions of people immediately.
Mm. Well, I think it is that like latter thing that still feels like the biggest crux to me. So again, I guess like reflecting on the effective altruism movement, I think one of the like key questions here is like, you know, how can we do the most good with the resources available to us? And maybe the like point of disagreement there is a question of what resources are available to us. Where in a local sense, you can just think, well, the resources I have are, you know, my personal donations, or maybe even the like institutions like directly within my influence. So I'm curious if you can like maybe spend some time like clearer spelling out how you see the path to influencing government budgets or large philanthropists and the like, such that we're like actually talking about that scale.
I think that the first thing is to understand that the problem of scale. So annual giving, official over to these overseas development assistance is about $180 billion a year. That means over 10 years, you're looking at close to $2 trillion. But that is a small amount of the overall spend of even governments in the developing world. Most cases, the development assistance is only about 5% of their GDP. In addition to that is the money in the world in general. The world money in the world in general is about $85 trillion US dollars in 2020. So if everybody in the world were to give 0.1%, let alone 1% of their money, there is a colossal amount of money available to tackle the problem of extreme poverty. There is no reason why we could not in our lifetimes very easily solve the scandal of extreme poverty. And to do it though, requires two things. It requires hope, convincing people there are practical things they can do which will make a difference to extreme poor. And secondly, I think reminding people of why extreme poverty is so horrifying. Because I think one of the sad things is that as we focus more and more on global health and on gender and on climate, we've taken our eyes off the basic reality of what it means to be living in a single room mud building, eating one meal a day with malnourished children and a low life expectancy and no access to education and this, that, and the other. So I think, and it's a difficult thing to talk about because we live in a world in which we don't wish to patronize people and we don't wish to propagate poverty porn. We have to find a way of being blunt and brutal about how horrifying poverty is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Give Directly has this nice line. You know, we have this proverb, teach a man to fish and he'll never be hungry or whatever. Most people already know how to fish. They just need to be able to, you know, afford the materials and they're up and running. Don't worry about setting up your fishing education program. And yet, I think you mentioned this already, but there is something very strange about the fact that very large donors, for instance, in the US, who might commit, you know, on the order of billions of dollars to a foundation in their name, and then, as far as I can tell, often die without having figured out how to give away half of that money, or at least they're on track to do that. And it's kind of confusing when there is such a simple argument to answer. How do you spend that last dollar of your giving? And it's quite simple.
It's a very interesting question, isn't it? I mean, one problem maybe about getting people properly into the field so that they can actually see the before and after, see what somebody in extreme poverty, the conditions they're living in, and then see how much difference is made in a matter of a few weeks by a single large cash transfer to their house, their livelihood, their meals, their livestock, their children, etc. But it may also be a problem of scale. I mean, it's very easy, I think, oddly, to convince an individual to support an individual. So, right. You know, right. There are many people who are happy to give $30 a month, and we compare them with one particular woman in Kenya, for example. And they can feel the impact of their money on that individual's mm-hmm. life.
Yeah, the identifiable victim, right?
Yeah. Maybe the problem is that when you scale up and say to the billionaire, you know, you can help with your money 3 million people, or you can lift an entire country out of poverty, they struggle to relate in the same way that you might relate to an identifiable person.
There are some studies on this. You can just show that there's a way to strictly help more people, but they haven't got names, and people will prefer to give the money to the smaller number of people with names. It's kind of baked into our psychology, I guess.
And then the problem is that we can, of course, we have the technology to share all the names, but once the names get to 3.5 million people, names cease to be names. Yeah.
Right. It's a long list. Yeah.
So one thing you mentioned closer to the beginning was wanting to run a really large scale RCT, which would likely require philanthropist support in the like single digit billions. I'm curious if there are any other intermediate outputs or goals like along the way to getting to this vision of a really like large scale, you know, cash transfer.
There are many intermediate stages. I mean, I think there's demonstrating it about at a smaller scale really powerfully the impact in an individual district and using the study on the district to answer all the questions that we need to answer before we go to the national scale. And that's something which small donations can really help towards, both grouping small donations together, which is something that we do a lot of and Give Directly, which is people who may be giving as little as $30 a month, but put together, we have enough money to really demonstrate something at a district level. Or larger donors who are prepared to support, for example, the technology. I mean, as we build out the pipes or the rails, allowing us to deliver the money to the extreme poor, that technology platform, that digital public infrastructure is also very, very helpful in the future for delivering money to women with children under 2 or delivering money to somebody in a climate affected area. So there is also huge opportunities for people giving at a smaller scale to support some of the enabling elements that would be required for that bigger push.
Is there anything in the space of advocacy or targeting some of the institutions or governments you mentioned that is like on Give Directly's radar or like work that you think would be concretely useful in the next 5 years?
Again, I think that would be hugely exciting. I mean, we have tended to be a delivery NGO more than an advocacy NGO because we've been very focused on efficiency. You know, we want at our best to be able to say for every $100 you give, $91 or $93 is arriving on the ground, which we can achieve in some of our very best programs. But it is also true that if we're actually going to change the world, we need to change the way that USAID and FCDO and the World Bank and the UN think about these things and the way that other philanthropists think about these things. And that does require policy work. That does require thought. That does require advocacy. And again, if there were donors who were prepared to support that in a way that didn't affect our general efficiency, that's something we'd love to do.
Okay, let's do some final questions. Here's one. Is civil society getting worse at arguing?
Yes, I think civil society is getting worse at arguing. And I think it's true for a number of reasons. I mean, one of them is civil society itself is under pressure all over the world. Governments are becoming more authoritarian, more populist on every continent. And there has been a marked decline in civil society over the last 17 years. But I also think we live in a culture in which argument itself is controversial, in which challenging opinions is difficult, in which we're increasingly sensitive to some of the problems of asserting an opinion strongly. And that can make argument and persuasion challenging.
Fantastic. And then I guess final question is, where can people learn more about your work and the work of GiveDirectly?
Well, thank you very much. Please, please go to our website. We're very proud of our website, givedirectly.org. We've got an enormous amount of data up there, links to academic studies. We've got GiveDirectly Live, which has a random collection of recipient stories, which people can look at. And I think it's a great resource to begin with if you want to start. But obviously, if you want to reach out to any of our staff, we're very happy to answer questions on individual programs.
Fantastic. Rory Stewart, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, so that was our interview with Rory Stewart. We just ended that 10 minutes ago. This is our Luca and Finn debrief. How do you think that went?
I thought it was a really interesting interview, and just getting to speak to somebody like Rory Stewart, who has had such a long career in global development and aid, was really cool. And also just seeing somebody like really fundamentally like change his view about like what aid is and what aid
should
be.
And presumably in quite a painful way.
Yeah. I think that like really came through in bits of the interview. I was thinking like it used to be the case that we would always end the interview with, you know, what's like one thing you've changed your mind on? And I think this whole episode was in some ways about that. What were your main takeaways from the interview?
Yeah, I think two stood out. One was this fairly bleak picture about just how inefficient perhaps most overseas aid from rich countries is, just in practice. Mm. And it's this gap, I guess, between the like nice sounding sentences about what the aid is aiming to achieve and then just how that translates to what happens on the ground. This is the story he told about the like program to get some kind of sanitation for girls in school was pretty stark. So that's one. Second one was just this kind of crazy mismatch between the fact that big philanthropists and also, I presume, foreign aid departments in rich countries struggle to think how to spend large amounts of money on alleviating poverty and global health. And then we just have this answer to like spend through to your last dollar and beyond that seems like pretty good.
Yeah. And having that answer makes things more depressing in a way, right? Like it could almost be that if it just happened to be the case that development assistance just isn't scalable, that the only things you can do are like very small, cost-effective things, but that's it. That would almost be in some ways a like less morally demanding world than it is the case that we can get billions of dollars and like have a like consistently robust positive impact.
Yeah. And it raises this question of why this isn't happening already. One answer, which I think Rory mentioned, was something about the psychology of paying into what is effectively an enormous pot, which is just getting redistributed directly to lots of people, to a very long list of people. And this maybe just kind of sounds less impressive, or even like you've put less thought into where you want to spend your philanthropic money than, you know, some foundation that's set up in your name. One way this overlaps in my head with some of the ideas of EA is this idea of taking your ego out of giving. You're giving to help people, not to make yourself look good, unless that can help more people. I feel good about some kind of cultural shift in this direction, you know, where like really trying to make it explicit that in your giving, you should just be doing often boring things that work rather than sexy things that don't work.
Yeah, I guess I'm still really intrigued of like how much of that point comes down to vanity and ego as opposed to passiveness. So how much of it is that, no, the person donating wants to, you know, have a really smart sounding idea or have something like really shiny to point towards versus that just being the default and most people just like don't do that like kind of scrutiny. I think I imagine also like where like looking at like different types of donors will get you different answers. I imagine that the kinds of questions that like are for a civil servant like in a government or, you know, a really large philanthropist are like somewhat different than individuals donating, where it's often like, oh, like this cause happens to be what the like supermarket checkout is asking me to donate
to. Yeah, that's a good point. I was probably much too quick there or like lumping people into the same bucket. I guess I was mostly talking, or I mostly had in mind very large philanthropic donors, but I guess the stories are different between different people.
Yeah, I'm still really intrigued. And I think it is still after this interview, an open question to me, at least, of like how much that can be changed or what the route to changing that is. I think this Give Directly case, and I think Rory Stewart like argued pretty powerfully that, you know, the world should raise its ambition and we should be doing this. But I think a really open question to me is like, can we do that? Or can an organization like Give Directly or like an advocacy org actually do that? Like, what is the concrete pathway to getting to that?
Yeah.
I really take the point, and I think Rory like mentioned that pretty explicitly, like a critique against effective altruism looking too narrowly at like things on the margin that like look really good. But I still like kind of have this feeling of like, yeah, if you don't have a lot of resources, then you do need to like triage and prioritize. And it's not obvious to me whether, you know, spending money on advocacy to get to make the pie bigger and to like make it go to cash is at the moment politically feasible, or what work can be done to make that politically feasible in the future. I wish we spent a bit more time on that.
Yeah. Okay. So just to get clear on what you're saying, we agree that it is in some sense possible for aid agencies to divert big parts of their budget to direct cash transfers and for philanthropists to give lots more money to cash transfers. The question is whether it's realistic enough to move far in that direction for it to make sense to like start advocating for it.
Yeah, I guess I would like to understand a bit better why historically has this not been the case, and yet at the same time we think that going forward this thing can be changed.
Yeah.
And I think like in one way this, you know, asks a really deep question about like what, you know, evidence for effectiveness like looks like. But in some ways I would like to have, you know, an RCT on like advocating for aid is like 10 times as cost effective as like just giving like cash directly. And if an organization like Give Directly explores these like advocacy things more, or at least like supports organizations that do, then I would also like to see the case spelled out for that. And I imagine that if a lot of these are like, if a lot of this theory of change comes down to like influencing a very small amount of people who control large number of resources like governments or really large philanthropists, then maybe that study just doesn't exist. But I would still want to explore a little bit more the like intuitive reasons for why that is possible, or what concretely gives Rory hope here that this is possible. I really took the message of hope, but I would like to see a bit more spelled out.
Do we have no indications that aid advocacy can be effective, as in advocacy for better aid policy and more aid spending? Right. So, some examples, right?
Yeah. So like Open Philanthropy, who I should flag is also like my employer, so conflict of interest is there, but did hire a program officer, Nora, recently to do foreign aid advocacy. And I think there is a lot of stuff promising there. And that's maybe somebody to like have on the show to talk about that like more concretely. But I think it is a really hard problem.
Sure. Overall, that was a really great conversation. I thought Rory Stewart, very cool that he's now president of Give Directly. And also, I'm just genuinely excited to see what they get up to in the next 2 or 3 years. I think in some sense right now, they're probably the fastest growing nonprofit in the world.
Yeah.
And if that continues, then that's just great.
I think recently, like GiveWell put them off their like list of like top charities. I think in part because GiveWell was having to like deal with the fact that, you know, there's like less funding in this space as they would like to be able to like fund everything. But I think Give Directly actually just like had a like really good reply to this, which I think like Rory
and we can link to it as well.
Which we'll like link to. And I think I'm really excited to see like what this just like very hopeful and ambitious, like large scale, cost effective cash transfer like aid looks like.
Love it. So
let's see in 5 years.
Let's do it.
That was Rory Stewart on Give Directly and massively scaling cash transfers. As always, if you want to learn more, you can read the write-up at hearthisidea.com/episodes/Stewart. There you'll find links to all the papers and books referenced throughout our interview, plus a whole lot more. And if you know of any other cool resources on these topics that others might find useful too, then please send them to us at feedback@hearthisidea.com.
Likewise, if you've got any constructive thoughts, then please email them to us or click on the website where we've got the link to an anonymous form under each episode, and you'll also receive a book for filling out our short survey. And lastly, if you want to support and help us pay for hosting these episodes online, then you can also leave us a tip by following the link in the description. A big thanks as always to our producer Jason for editing these episodes, and thanks very much to you for listening.